On today's episode of the Weird and Well podcast, I am joined by the amazing Holly Blanc Moses. For nearly three decades, Holly Blanc Moses, who is a mom and neurodivergent therapist, has helped hundreds of neurodivergent children, teens, and adults build happier, more peaceful lives. She trains therapists, teaches online masterclasses for parents, and speaks at conferences, schools, and organizations about neurodiversity-affirming care. Holly hosts the Autism ADHD podcast and Autism ADHD TV, where she and her guests explore topics like mental health, executive functioning, emotional regulation, social connection learning, independence, and self-advocacy. She's also the owner of the North Carolina Center for Autism and ADHD in Raleigh, where she and her team offer therapy, comprehensive evaluations, and parenting intensives. And at the heart of all of it, she is herself neurodivergent and a mom to two incredible neurodivergent boys. In the first part of today's episode, Holly shares her experience and the ways that she serves neurodivergent families. And in the later part of the episode, she gets very vulnerable about her experiences with chronic illness and her chronic illness journey. So keep that in mind if you have medical trauma. Hello, Holly. Welcome to the Weird and Well podcast. I'm so grateful to have you here today. I would love to start by having you share a little bit of your kind of what you do, and then we can look at your journey that kind of led you to this point, because I know that the work you do is very rooted in both your training, but also very much in lived experience. And so I'd love to hear a little bit of who you work with, what you do, and then we'll go from there.
I love it. I'm thrilled to be here. And I'm glad that we were finally able to connect with our schedule. So that's very exciting. We had lots of emails going back and forth, but we made it happen. I have been supporting neurodivergent people for the last 28 years. And it's always been what I wanted to do. Always. I mean, I remember doing experiments, behavior experiments, in first grade, even. I would do experiments where I would act like I lost my contact, my eye contact, you know, in the freezer section to see what type and characteristics of people would attempt to help me. So it's just all these things where nobody would else would think to do that, right?
Yeah.
But I will say, Elizabeth, that this one woman was so lovely that I literally had to tell her to stop looking because it's not there.
Oh.
We're not leaving until we find this contact. I mean, she was amazing. And then I felt kind of bad, but she was a good sport about it. So I've always wanted to do this. I've always been interested in why were things harder for some people and easier than others? Why was socializing easier for some people than others? What was this social hierarchy all about? And it was really confusing, and also learning differences. You know, I knew that in some ways it was harder for me than maybe the kid next to me in class. Yeah. So it's always been an interest, and I hit the ground running, you know, with school when it was actually something I was interested in college, because you actually get to do a little more of what you're interested in, you know, so exciting. Yeah. So I did research and did all the things. And then just kept going, you know, going to graduate school. And that's all led to me having a private practice in Raleigh, North Carolina. It's the North Carolina Center for Autism and ADHD. And so we provide mental health services, comprehensive evaluations, and also I do some coaching too on the side, have the Autism ADHD podcast, which you are coming on to visit me.
I'm excited.
I'm very excited to have you. So, and then the lived experience. So I can actually say with all sincerity that I get it. I was that kid. I am that adult. I am that parent. You know, we adopted our kids from foster care, and I know what it's like to wear the hats. And so I think that can be really helpful when it comes to supporting other people. I don't know what it's like exactly to be there in their shoes, but I have a really good idea.
Yeah. And I've found that that makes such an enormous difference in all of the different ways that I've worked with neurodivergent individuals and myself as, you know, a neurodivergent individual getting support. It makes such a huge difference to be working with someone who has that lived firsthand experience so that they're able to look past the surface. If you don't know what it feels like inside to be experiencing some of these things, and yes, everybody is different, every experience is different. But if you don't have that firsthand experience of here's what it feels like in my body when this is happening, and you're just going off of the external, here's what it looks like, then there's so many miscommunications that happen. There are so many things that sometimes the treatment is not necessarily appropriate to what that person needs because it's just looking at the surface level, right? It makes such a huge difference. Also just in feeling seen and feeling heard and feeling a sense of belonging and acceptance, which is so important to the healing and recovery process.
Well, beautifully said. And I could riff off everything that you just said, by the way. It was lovely.
We could just spend like 8 hours just like.
We could spend 20 million hours talking
info
about.
Info dumping and just like and back and forth.
Maybe we will. Maybe we're just going to do a whole show that's like just an intensive or something. But that, yep. But the, you're right. And what we see is just a tiny, tiny bit. And mm-hmm. most of us, and understandably so, we've been shaped by our society. Yeah. To have an expectation of what you see on the outside. And people want information. They want to know the reason for things. And I find that the default will be that kid is bad. That parent is bad.
Yeah.
I saw, and she's a lovely person. She's a therapist, a neighbor of mine. I saw her out walking her dog just a couple days ago, and I was walking my dog. And we're having this conversation, and she's telling me about this teenager who is so great, so responsible, who's been helping her with her lawn. He's such a hard worker. He's so respectful. He's always very kind. He always does extra. And his mom raised him right. And it was like somebody was shoving a knife in my ear. She did not mean to hurt me. She did not mean that in any other way, but to say, this child is showing up the way that I think he should, and that's a good thing. So I thought, do I have the bandwidth to do some teaching here? And the answer was yes.
Good. Although oftentimes that's not the case, and that's totally valid.
And that's also
it is not, it's not our responsibility to emotionally educate other people, especially if it's putting your own health and ability to take care of yourself, you know, second.
So,
but I love that you're able to be there.
Yeah. In that moment, now I've been in lots of situations where I just could not, could not do it.
I just cannot today. I totally get that.
And not only that, you're probably attending to your child who's more important for your attention than some goofball who doesn't know anything. So I explained to her in a very nice way, we only talked briefly, but you know that I'm probably a pretty reasonable, nice person. And so I said, I don't think that you meant to hurt my feelings in any kind of way. What you meant was you really appreciated this, and his mother raised him well, and I'm sure she did. I said, but sometimes for neurodivergent people, there is a societal idea that if a child isn't behaving responsibly, whatever that looks like, isn't working hard, whatever that looks like, then they are lazy, they are bad, they're disrespectful. The parents are bad. They didn't raise them right.
Yeah.
And
the pressure that puts on the parent to then try and get their child to conform to whatever the societal expectations is, it creates a situation where the parent who genuinely loves their child and wants to be there and wants to support them and help them, you know, live their best life is torn between being able to be present for and recognizing what their child actually needs and trying to get the results that are going to be acceptable by society and are going to get that response of, oh, they were raised right, instead of, what the hell were your parent? Where were your parents? Why did they not fix this quote unquote problem? You know, whatever, right? And you know, that leads to then a higher rate of trauma for the kid, a higher rate of dysregulation and stress for both the child and the parent. And it just creates all of these like snowball effects down the road because we have these ingrained societal expectations.
Exactly. Because I did say my kid would not be doing your lawn for that. I mean, he just would not. I don't care how much money you give him. So it, and she was very nice. Of course, you're not going to get that all the time, right? And you have to be safe in those situations. You don't want to like confront somebody that's, it's not going to be a safe person for you. But I really appreciated her. She said, I'm really sorry. I did not mean that to hurt you. And I said, I don't think you did at all. Yeah. I really like you. This isn't about that. I just felt like I needed to, you know, explain when you use language like he was raised right, that then shows other parents like then your kid was raised wrong.
Mm-hmm. Hashtag ableism.
Hashtag.
So I know that therapy is your primary kind of thing that you've been doing for so long, and you also offer these coaching services. Tell me more about the coaching services. What is it you do? Who are you serving? What are the things that you are working on in coaching with people?
I love coaching because they are parents that are ready for something different. They are saying, I want to be a cycle breaker, right? Like I want to have a relationship with my kid. I don't want them to be drowning in shame. I want to have a relationship with them. I want them to trust me. I want them to know they can come to me because they are constantly surrounded by confusion. Yeah. And if they don't have someone, then that leads to more anxiety and depression. And a lot of times, you know, it helps a parent to be able to step back and see all the pieces and all the parts and helping them identify maybe what's getting in their way of moving forward with the relationship they ultimately want and how they want to support their child and what boundaries look like with not only their child, but other people, you know, in the community, maybe even extended family. So I think coaching can be really, really helpful. It's certainly not mental health therapy. So I, you know, just want to throw that out there. Those are two different kinds of services. But I do think that coaching can be so helpful for families.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you were to say like the number one switch or skill or thing that shifts for parents when they are coaching with you, what would that be? What's like the number one thing, and how does that affect their ability to show up and be present and be the parent that they want to be with their child?
There's so many turning points, but I'll point out a couple that I think are really big ones. Is how do you want them to think of you? How do you want your child to think of you? Do you want to be thought of as a safe person or an unsafe person? And that's big. That's something that really takes up a room.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times, if you're not talking about that part, there is no foundation. It's not about coming in and throwing some strategies at people. They've been there, done that. What is the goal? What kind of relationship do you want? And also recognizing, again, those barriers that are getting in the way. Is it a societal should be or have to? Do you have an idea that your child has to progress on this timeline somebody said somewhere at one point was the right way.
Yeah. Absolutely. What you said sparked something and then it flew away. I'm going to see if I can get it to fly back. Oh, yeah. Okay. That aspect of whether or not you are being a safe space and a safe person for your child is so huge, not just in the relationship and in your child's ability to grow and learn and be able to access different skills, but it's also fundamental to their well-being long-term. Like, it helps them to create that foundation of, you know, we've talked about co-regulation and that kind of stuff, that having that foundation of a safe space, a place where they feel belonging, is so huge. And I think that when it comes to parents, especially if they're neurodivergent themselves and they're coming from these different backgrounds, maybe they're undiagnosed, maybe their families were undiagnosed because it runs in families, you know, and they're doing their best. They're really showing up and doing their best, but they may not realize that they're not providing that safe space or being that safe person for their kid. And so I think bringing that to kind of a conscious awareness level of like, yes, this is important. And it's probably not something you were necessarily taught how to do. Or if you were, you know, maybe you've heard about it or you've had different approaches taught to you, but maybe they weren't ones that fit with your brain and body and your kid's brain and body. Like, how can we adapt that so that it's something that is accessible and sustainable for you and in your relationship with your kid?
Yeah, it's true. It can make all the difference in the world. And parents want that. You know, they want to be that safe person, but like you said earlier, they are surrounded by judgment. They're surrounded by maybe well-meaning teachers or therapists or whoever, and they want to do what they're told to do, but it's not always a fit for that child. And unfortunately, and you probably have had this experience as well, when you have lived experience and you talk to those adults, you'll hear that I didn't have any safe people. I couldn't go to anyone. I didn't know what to do in this situation, which makes them even more vulnerable to abuse, to neglect, to bullying, and all those things. I think parents really want that. And a parenting coach can be really helpful in helping to map that out and walking next to them through it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do. I see that in the moms that I work with. Obviously, I don't do parenting coaching. I do. You know, there's I can make the words and they will come out right. I do the nervous system coaching for women who experience anxiety, burnout, chronic illness. And a lot of the moms that I work with, they're also trying to navigate kind of figuring out how do I say that? A lot of the moms I work with are navigating between how much they rely on what other people are telling them about their child and what they quote unquote should be doing and what feels right and authentic for them. And because so many of them have a significant loss of trust within themselves and within their own intuition, and they have this history of being gaslighted and they have this history of masking, and they struggled to make and keep boundaries because all of that was part of how they survived, that then when they're showing up for their kid, it makes it that much harder for them to be able to advocate for their kid, to be able to recognize, wait, you know, here's this authority figure who's telling me something, but it's not right for my family. We need something different. And to be able to honor that, hear it and honor that intuition and that inner knowledge that's coming through. And so that's a shift that I see a lot with the clients I work with that nervous system healing and that building self-trust and awareness and intuition, that then they're able to access a lot of the things that you're talking about that are so important and being able to show up and be present and build the approach and the relationship that's right for them and their child.
It's true. When you think about neurodivergent parents, right, they have probably since the beginning of their memory, their emotions have been minimized. Their thoughts, their feelings were minimized. Don't be
Invalidated, yeah.
dramatic. You're too
Yep.
sensitive. You're making a big
Stop
deal out of
crying.
nothing.
Yep.
Suck it up.
Yep.
Right? So they've heard that for literally forever. They're forever. So they're always second guessing. And now, they're maybe sitting at the table at school in an IEP meeting or 504 meeting being told all
Yeah.
these things, and they know they're not allowed to push back to, they know people pleasing is the only thing that's gotten them through in life and
The fawn
masking.
response is hard. I literally just had a meeting with my son's school last week, and I knew going into it my fawn response was going to be activated. And I had to record the meeting, and I was like, I'm going to have to listen to this again and process and figure out. Because when I left that meeting, I knew I was going to be disoriented and not be able to tell if they had actually addressed what I was there to talk about or just kind of like my fawn response had kicked in, right? And that's something that I know that I experience, and I know a lot of other people experience. I'm an interrupter. Sorry, go ahead, finish.
I am also an interrupter, but the fawn, like you were saying, I'm so glad that that's getting more airtime, because I also, if you open up the dictionary for fawning for, a nervous system response, my picture would also be in there, because that was survival, right? That's
Yep.
how we had to do it.
Yeah. And I think especially in situations when you're interacting with your kid like that and you're being put in these situations where you were a kid in that situation, there's so much traumatic memory in your body and there's so much nervous system response stored in there. Like, I just went to a middle school for the first time in like 20 years and I was not prepared for how my body would call back to my middle school experience. There was definitely some processing after that where I was like, "Whoa, I did not think that was going to happen." But like a lot of these situations where you are advocating for your kid, whether it's at a school or with a doctor or with other kinds of parents or professionals, like in any of those spaces, there's going to be a body memory of how you experienced it and that's going to come into play. And until you have that awareness and you have that, like you process through and release all of that stuff, then it's going to be kind of there in the background, factoring into what's happening.
Absolutely, I agree.
I would love to hear more about your personal chronic illness experience because that's something that comes up a lot with my clients that I work with, and in this community, there's such a high rate of chronic illness within neurodivergent women, and there are so many reasons for that that I talk about in other places. But I think it's so helpful to hear from, I think it's so helpful to hear the different perspectives and experiences of women who have gone through this and I would love to hear your story if you're open to sharing it.
Yeah, and I don't know if you'll be open to this, Elizabeth, but your work is so important and has inspired me to even be open to sharing more of my chronic illness journey with my own audience, because that's something that I personally have been avoiding and masking, because that's just
Yeah.
what I knew to do. So I'm just going to invite you to interview me on my
Yeah.
podcast about it, because I feel like when you're walking next to me, I'll feel, more supported
Yeah.
in
Well,
that.
thank you. I'm so honored. I would love to do that.
So my freshman year in college, I mean, I had headaches. I had other symptoms before that, but I'm 51. And back then, suck it up. That was your, you don't go to the doctor unless like your eye comes out or something. And
Yeah.
even then, not then. So this was this idea where you just don't go, period. Plus, they'd have to pay for it, and they're not going to do that. So it was just this thing where you don't talk about it.
Yeah.
You suck it up, you don't talk about it, you fawn, I never learned how to even advocate for myself, because every time I tried to do it, it was like, no way, don't you be disrespectful. It doesn't matter. You know, kids are to be seen and not heard. Okay. Yep. So my freshman year, I was attending, and again, I always knew I wanted to be a psychologist. So I was attending this Psych 101 class, my first semester. And I remember the professor had said, any of you who want to go through and get your PhDs in psychology, you have to have the best grades. You have to do all the research. You have to constantly be volunteering. You have to do everything, or you don't have a chance of getting in. And I obviously take things literally too.
Yeah.
So I thought, oh no, this thing that I've wanted to do my whole life will not happen unless I do all these things. And not only do I do all these things, I have to be better than everyone else, because everyone's a superstar, is what she said, that's even applying. And there's only a couple spots ever, right, for those schools. Yeah. So the first week, I remember going into the psych department, and you walk in, any of you have been to college, there's a main office, right, in the building. And so I went in the main office, and I looked to the left, and I saw this kind of shiny plaque, and it caught my attention. And it turned out that there was this award. They pick the department, the psychology department picks one student who's graduating. This is a massive school, like huge university. One student who is the best, and they get this award.
Yeah.
Okay, my first week of college. My thought was, when I saw that shiny plaque, is 4 years, excuse me, 1 second. And I'll say that again so you can edit it. My first thought was, 4 years from now, my name will be on that plaque, and then I'll be good enough. And I look back at that kid, right? Because I was a kid, of how much pain and how much masking and how much fawning and how much all the things no safe people, trying to constantly prove that I wasn't bad, that I was valuable in some way, and I couldn't figure out how to do it. Like when I was in middle school, I was just annoying socially, so that didn't work. So then in high school, I just stopped talking, and then I was stuck up, and I put all my effort into my appearance. And I would stim, like I would like go back and forth. I would put my clothes out on my bed, and I would just pace. And look at I'd get up 2 hours early before high school to make sure my hair was perfect, because I couldn't control anything else. And I will say, Elizabeth, that at the senior dinner for high school, I did get overall best appearance. Right? So
worth it.
Right? Like, who the hell cares about that? But I mean, at the time, you could see how much effort that I'm putting in it. And a lot of us that are neurodivergent feel like we have no control over anything. And so whether it's eating, whether it's grades, whether it's appearance, whatever that is, like we have to grab on and hold on tight and put 100,000% into that one thing. So here it is, 4 years from now, in this moment, my name will be up there and I will finally be good enough. Okay. So I poured everything into school. It was ridiculous. I barely slept. I didn't have any money because I'm paying for my own school. So I'm like eating, you know, for sale hot dogs, you know, at the store with like a double coupon or whatever. And My second semester, I ended up being one of the teachers for that class, by the way. My second semester of my freshman year, I ended up teaching the
Yeah.
breakout sessions for that very class, by the way. So it was intense.
Yeah.
I started bleeding. And like rectally, I started bleeding and I didn't tell anybody because I grew up like, you don't tell, first of all, you certainly don't tell anybody that. Like, that's a very
Yeah.
personal thing, right? And so there wasn't anyone that I felt like would believe me. Number one,
Yeah.
maybe I'm being dramatic, as everyone would say, or
Yeah.
it'll go away.
Drama
Don't worry about
queen.
it. Suck it up, right?
Yeah.
And so these massive stressors, and I had pushed my nervous system so far, but even before I got to college, is that it just tipped over. There
Yeah.
was nothing left. I had been running on empty. My tank had been empty for, I don't know, since I was probably in
Years,
elementary
yeah.
school.
Yep.
So it's push, 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 prove myself that I'm not bad. I got to prove, I got to prove, I got to prove. And work so much harder because I know I have undiagnosed learning disabilities, which made everything so much harder. So pushing through, pushing through, when my body decided that you could just can't, like you cannot physically
Yeah. Yeah.
anymore. It's not possible. So what ended up happening is I
Yeah.
didn't tell anyone. And it got worse. And it got worse. And I
Yeah.
finally, at the end of my freshman year, said something to my mom. And I said, it's probably not a big deal. You know, we even do that, right? Like, even when we're gonna say something, it's like, it's probably nothing.
Right?
It's probably not a big deal. I don't mean to
This probably
complain.
isn't a thing.
It's probably nothing. I
Yeah.
mean, it's not like whatever, but yeah, so I'm like, I have some internal bleeding. Like when I think back, like how we're,
Yeah.
that's kind of a big deal, right? It's just some internal bleeding. I'm sure
Yeah.
it'll be fine.
I
So
think
she.
that's so common though with neurodivergent women is our frame of reference is so off because we've had such a history of gaslighting and invalidation that we really like and we're very determined and we push through and we try to figure out and then it's not until much later we look back and we're like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Like
How did
that
that
was so
even?
much worse than I thought it was.
It was bad. It was
Yeah.
bad. And I was in a lot of pain. Of course, I didn't say that, right?
Right.
So
Can't be a burden.
she, yeah. And I'm like a kid. I don't know about GI doctors. Like I didn't even go to the regular doctor, like
Yeah.
the regular pediatrician, you know? So it's like, what am I supposed to even do with this? So she did make me an appointment with this very sketchy doctor. I don't think she realized either, you know. And here's this authority figure because I grown up like you don't question anything. You, especially a doctor, right? You do, they know everything. And I know
Yeah.
nothing, right?
Yeah.
And so he was saying, oh, you know, I think you have, and then they did some tests. Oh, you have, you know, ulcerative colitis. Okay. Well, what does that mean? You know, what does this look like? And I had an idea because one of my friends that I grew up with, my friend Eric, who's a lovely human being, he had, they thought he had UC and ended up being Crohn's. So he got sick in high school.
Yeah.
So I knew a little bit about it. And of course, I didn't tell anybody, right? Like I was very careful. It was, you know, one of those things you don't talk about too. Not only are you sick, but you don't talk about that. You
Yeah.
know, you don't talk about anything intestinal because that's just embarrassing.
Yeah.
So I had struggled a lot. I was in and out of the hospital quite a bit, and I wouldn't even tell anyone. I wouldn't even tell my parents. So
Yeah.
here was me, you know, I'm in the hospital. I'd be in the hospital for a few days, then hop back up on medicine, and this like went back and forth until it just got
While you're
progressively
juggling full-time school.
right.
Yeah.
And not just full-time school, all the things I had to do on the side because I wasn't going to be able to get my PhD. Yeah.
Because you had to volunteer and you had to, like, you had to be the best candidate. Yeah.
The best. Because I had to get that plaque, right? My name had to be on that plaque. So
that's the only way you're going to prove your worth.
Exactly. Because I would just continue to be bad and stupid and, you know, irritating and annoying if I didn't.
Yeah. And if you discovered that you weren't good enough to do this thing that you had personally identified with since you were 6 years old, like, how life-shattering would that be? It's no wonder that you had such a huge nervous system threat response of, no, there's no other option. This has to happen.
And I was constantly worried.
Yeah.
And, you know, in and out of the hospital, obstructions, bleeding, flares, all the things. And it got to the point where a few times they didn't know if I was going to make it. And I was studying the whole time I was in the hospital. Like, that did not stop because I couldn't get behind, right?
Yeah.
And then the advocacy part is so tough too, because when you're young and you've never in your whole life been listened to or able to tell anyone no, or explain even. No one will even let you explain. And that's why we over-explain a lot of the time, right? And I remember back then, like, the professors even, well, I don't believe you. You're just trying to get out of the test coming up. No, I'm legit in the hospital. There is one professor that actually told me that I had to give him the phone number of one of my doctors. Because he didn't believe me. Yeah. I'm like, who would make this up? Who would go to the hospital? They don't admit you anyway if nothing's wrong with you. Like, this is ridiculous. But that was my life. And it prevented me from doing a lot of things like other people got to do. Like, I don't know, walk to class and not, you know, mess on myself. Like, these
not being excruciating pain, I would imagine.
Yeah, like sitting there in class and wanting to cry.
Yeah.
But I have to act like I'm okay.
Yeah.
And not only that, I have to act like I'm better than I'm okay, because then they're not going to give me their research project that I'm going to be able to be, you know, published on or whatever. So there was this tremendous pressure. And then there were these kind of arguments, is it UC, is it Crohn's, like back and forth too. So then it was time to apply for graduate school. And I had done all the things. I was president of the Honor Society. I had not only done an honors thesis, because most people don't, it's the equivalent of a master's thesis as an undergrad. And I did that. And I was the youngest in the history of the school. Yeah. So I'm like, I'm on my way of proving that I'm not a terrible, horrible person. And even though I'm dying, and that's not an exaggeration.
Right.
So, So I made it on that wall. I did.
How do you feel about that now?
Well, it was interesting, the graduation, like, the school's so huge that there was like a big giant university graduation that I didn't bother going to, but there was a department one. And because I was the president and everything else, like, I had to be there and speak, and you could barely hear me because I was so nervous and worried. And they don't tell you ahead of time if you're getting this award. They present it at the graduation. Oh. So I'm sitting there about to be sick.
Yeah.
Because here my life is finally, either it's going to be true that I'm valuable or I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
And when she called my name, I thought I was going to pass out. Like, because I said 4 years before, this is what has to happen. And I about killed myself, literally, trying to get it. And what was so wild about it is after the ceremony, like, just had ended, a family member who I had been probably trying to prove myself most to said, you know, you don't have to do all this stuff. It doesn't, like, matter to us.
Oh, great.
4
That's
years.
so great to hear.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. And so that was a, I don't know, a punch across the face. And
Yeah.
then I started crying. Not crying, bawling. Like my crying is, you wouldn't even know I'm crying if you're in, I'm in the same room. Like tears are just coming down because you know how we learn to do it quietly, right? And one of the professors, actually the one that presented me with the award, and she was like, "Oh, it's okay. You know, I know it's so sad that, you know, it's graduation and, you know, whatever." And I'm like, "No, I'm crying because I'm so happy it's over." And she looked at me like I had 20 heads.
Oh my
And I was
gosh.
just so relieved.
She was probably like, but you love school,
Yeah.
but you love being here and doing all of this
Well, I
stuff.
must. I
Like, you
mean,
are,
look at all my accomplishments, right? And it had, I mean, yes, I love psychology, but but really, it was I was driving myself into the ground to try to prove my that I was not, you know, a piece of crap, right? So
And
because
it's
of
such a
my,
double-edged,
yeah.
I was going to say, that's such a double-edged sword because so many masking neurodivergent women, like, we get these labels of determination and she's so resilient, right? And like that becomes a part of our mask, as like that's the only way that we know how to function and to get the things done is to be determined and resilient and have grit and all that kind of stuff. But as you said, like shared in your story, like the entire time that you're operating that way, it's causing more and more damage to your mental and physical health. And that's not sustainable. And at some point, it's going to collapse.
And that's exactly what happened. So, because of my learning differences, my scores on the GREs weren't great. Like, here I was, six publications as an undergrad and research article. I mean, peer reviewed. That's like unheard of, right? The first in everything, and then people are passing me by. And then I feel I'm right back in that same space. I'm not good enough, right? Like, what happened? So I worked for a couple years before I went to graduate school. And in that time, again, in the hospital, back and forth, back and forth. But it got the disease, of course, it was horrible. It was Crohn's. Right? Like it wasn't UC. So, which means that, you know, if I had ulcerative colitis and they took out my colon, I would supposedly be cured. Right? And Crohn's can occur anywhere from your mouth down. Like it can happen anywhere. So, I was shooting for UC. Not that you would ever want to, because that's also terrible. But it turned out that, you know, it was Crohn's disease and it was a very
Of
serious.
the two options, I want the one where they
Yeah.
remove my part of my
Right.
intestines.
Most people don't even ever say that in their whole life, right? So I didn't, you know, get that. So it was Crohn's and it was not only Crohn's, but I knew it was a, I had a severe case because some people, you know, it can be really tough. Like they have to watch what they eat. They have to just, you know, sometimes they'll have flares. But for me, there was never not a flare. There was never, it was always active disease that was eating away at my tissue, like my body.
Not
So,
to mention the
yeah.
whole time that you're experiencing that without it being diagnosed, without it being treated, while you have all of these other stressors, all of that's compounding so that your body's not getting the nutrients that it needs, which is going to affect your brain function. It's going to affect your nervous system. It's going to affect your body's ability to, do cell reproduction, like all of these different things that are getting compounded because of that as well. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. And not sleeping
And not
because
sleeping.
I can't sleep more than 10, 15 minutes without having to get up to go to the bathroom. And the pain. Like, I mean, it's like an impossible situation. So I go off to graduate school to a different state where I don't know anyone. And here it ramps up again. I mean, not that it was not that it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy then either, but like the pressure It's a pressure cooker. Like, this is not a nervous system friendly environment. Clinical psych is not.
Plus graduate school, plus being in a completely new location, completely new environment,
New
new people,
doctors.
like completely new routines, like everything, all of that is going to contribute.
Everything. So I was trying to manage walking to school because I got an apartment. It was, I think, like 4 blocks because parking was really bad. I can't tell you the many times that I would attempt to leave and I wouldn't make it. I would have a mess on myself. Sorry. I would have to walk back to the house and change again. And then I would get in trouble for being late. So I would make sure that I had extra clothes with me, at least 2 sets of extra clothes at all times. And being able to not pass out in the middle of class and do the work because I also could not eat or drink at all until I got home that night. So just this constant struggle, and it just got worse. I would have to go in on the weekends into the hospital for IV nutrition. And when I wasn't, like, if it wasn't a planned inpatient, then I was going through the ER for like an obstruction or I'd lost a lot of blood. It was always something. So I missed most of my first semester of graduate school because I was in the hospital. I had to go back to my original doctors back into the last state because they had to take out my large intestine. Like, I was dying. So there was no choice anymore. Well, there was a choice. You either die or this happens. Like, that's where we're at
There's
here.
always a choice, but the
And you can
choice was
also
death.
die from the surgery. So either way, let's try it.
Roll the dice.
There's something really hard about getting an ileostomy as a young 20-something single woman. And you think that no one is ever going to marry me. Nobody is ever going to, they're going to think I'm disgusting. And that has happened, right? Like, people told me that. So there's more to hide,
And
right?
even especially back at that time, because now, now we have some like more visibility, especially on social media, around people who have
Yeah. There was
those
no social media.
experiences. They're living their lives, and so it becomes it's there's more of a normalization and more exposure to it now, I think. Whereas at that time, I would guess that most of the people that you met had never
No.
encountered anything like that, and they were, and then the ableism kicks in, the fear of the unknown kicks in, the need to other, like all of that stuff would come in and be directed at you, who's just, a young woman who's literally dying and just
He's
trying to
literally dying.
survive
Exactly. In graduate school. It's
in
already
graduate
not
school.
a healthy environment. So there were things that happened that were really hard, obviously. They did think they were going to be able to reverse it. So I had a pouch for, I think it was 8 or 9 months, and then they reversed it and made a J pouch. Like, they kind of, whoever's familiar with that, the terminology, kind of almost like tried to make a colon out of your small bowel, right? Well, the disease was so bad, it just ate right through it. I mean, it didn't take much time at all to be like,
Well, I
that's
mean,
just,
all of the
yeah.
stress is still there. All of the things that are causing and contributing and exacerbating what's happening in your body are still absolutely present and compounding. So it makes sense that it,
And
like it
yeah.
would be too intense.
Right. And not only that, I had to make up all of that work. I was then already behind, right? Because I was going to get kicked out of the program because back in the day, I mean, I could sue now, but back in the day, I had to get up in front of a panel and plead and beg for them to keep me in the program when none of this was my fault. So there were things that happened where I remember my guy had been on prednisone for, I don't know, I think 10 years at that point, and it
Prednisone.
was like eating away at my teeth. I mean, it's
Oh.
such a hard drug, right? And I was
Yeah.
prednisone dependent, so I
Yeah.
would blow up, 50, 60 more pounds, and then you might see me a month later and I'm like 90. I mean, it was just confusing. So my teeth were breaking and I didn't have any money. So I went to the dentist and said, whatever you got to do, give me a fake tooth. I'll pop it in there. I don't care. I don't even care. I didn't know this dentist. I was in a state. I didn't know anyone. And he had just looked at my file for a second and saw that I had Crohn's disease. So I'm laying back in the dentist chair, which is not comfortable anyway. And he starts talking about Crohn's disease. And he says to me, I'm this young woman with a pouch. He says, I always told my family that I would rather be dead. Kill me if either one of these two things happen. I can't remember the name of the cancer, but the cancer where it's in your mandible, like you lose
Yeah.
the lower half of your face, he would
Like
rather
jaw
die
cancer. Yeah.
or have a bag. Just kill him.
The ableism is so deep.
And I'm laying there
Yeah.
and I start tearing up. And I said, it was almost like my first little tiny baby step, but so big for me when I said, so do you think it's better for me to be dead?
Yes.
No, I said it very
Yes.
quietly. It was like almost a whisper. And almost like I was saying it, but I was so scared. But I was also
Did
so
he do?
hurt, right?
Yeah.
And he said, "Do you have one?" I was like, "Yes." And he goes, "Oh, sorry." And that was so big for me.
Yeah.
So big for me. So it was just like this secret. I didn't want people to think I was sick because if I was sick, they would think I'm not capable.
Yeah.
Right. And so there's that, I got to hide that too. But how do you hide being in the hospital? At one of the times I was hospitalized my first semester, I was in for over a month in the hospital. And I'll give you an example of kind of this neurodivergent thing that we have to be careful of too. It kind of plays into what we were saying earlier. When I was getting discharged, finally, right? I was excited, but I told my doctor that morning, I said, something's wrong. I can't breathe. Oh, it's fine. Right? It's because you've been laying down for a long, you know what I mean? You're excited because you're leaving
Yeah.
finally. You've been here forever, all
Like,
the
I
things.
think, I just want to say, I think that there's definitely the neurodivergent component that comes into it, and that for some reason as neurodivergent people, even when we are able to express what we're experiencing, that it is devalued, misunderstood, that kind of stuff. There's also the component of being a woman, and that there's, a lot of research and documentation that shows that trying to advocate for yourself, whether it's at school or in a medical environment, that there is a much higher rate historically of not being believed, of not being listened to, of not receiving the treatments that you need if you're a woman versus a man. So there's definitely some intersectionality happening there that I see
And I
a
look really
lot.
young.
And yeah, and the young and the youth portion, you don't know what you're talking about.
It was all the things you just said are true. It was all of those things. And as soon as he minimized my experience, I shut down, just like I always did,
Yep.
because it didn't
Yep.
matter what I was going to say. They weren't going to listen to me, just like no one else listened to me. And so they discharged me, even though I said I couldn't breathe. The next day, my feet turned purple. And I could barely, I mean, obviously, I hadn't stood up. I mean, you're gonna, after you're in the hospital for so long, your body, it's like you can't even use it anymore. You're so weak.
Yeah. I was bedridden for 2 years with chronic illness where I could barely get up, barely do anything. And all of my muscles, like I went from being a very strong fitness coach with like toned muscles and strength and able to do and walk for whoever knows how long to I could barely stand on my own. And when I sat down, my legs just became pancakes because my muscles were completely atrophied.
So true. And it's scary.
It
It's
is.
scary where you're stuck in this thing that's not working,
Yep.
right? And so I was
And
like,
it breaks even when there is any kind of trust with your body, which oftentimes when you have chronic illness, the trust and healthy relationship with your body is very limited anyways. But then to not be able to function at all or do the things that you were able to do before, like it just erodes that even more.
it's true. It's like the perfect storm. And so I went to another hospital and they right away knew what was wrong, that I had pulmonary emboli, right? So no wonder I couldn't breathe.
Yeah.
I have blood clots in my lungs that went through my heart. And I thought, are you kidding me? I'm already missing graduate school. I've got to get
Yep.
back.
Yeah. Of course, and that's what you think, right? It's not like, oh no, I have this health problem that I need to focus on and I need to heal and recover and find the right supports. It's I need to get back to functioning so I can get back to maintaining the status quo so I can get back to the path that I was on, right?
Yeah. I mean, my body, I hated it. It was my enemy, just like your swirly. I mean, it felt like I hate you. I hate you. You're this massive barrier to me. This is not my plan. This is not my plan of how I have to prove myself, right?
And that's something that takes so long to really process and heal like that at that specific aspect, the relationship with the body. Because even as you heal, and that lack of trust, right? There's that fear of, but at any point my body could betray me and I could get sick again,
Any
right?
second.
And any second, exactly. And so having that in and of itself, like that's one of the things that I work on with my clients when they get to a certain point in their recovery, because continuing to have that in there, it causes anxiety and it causes like it's dysregulating to the nervous system to have that always chattering in the back of your brain of, but any moment I could lose, but I could go back to where I was and I can't do that again, right? So, but yeah, absolutely. Like it's so holistically harmful. You're not just healing your body, you've got to heal your mental health, you've got to heal your relationship, you've got to heal your soul.
No, it's so true. It's so true. And obviously, I didn't have the insight and awareness that I
No,
now, all these
absolutely
decades
not.
later. So it was just that I hate my body. It ruins everything. I'm never going to be able to do what I'm never going to be able to prove myself. You know, and it's terrible. It's more now that I have to hide, right?
To
So
meet social expectations, right?
yeah.
If I have any chance of doing, of becoming getting my doctorate, if I have any chance of getting married and having kids, if I have any chance of being socially acceptable and not being exiled, then I have to hide this stuff that's happening. Yeah. It's
Exactly.
life or death,
It is, it
even if
literally
it's going to kill you
is.
to do it.
Exactly. And that's what it was. I was literally dying in an effort to prove myself that I was not bad, or I was not worthless, I was not lazy, right? So, they did let me continue. And of course, I pushed myself farther, got caught back up, which is, and this program is so hard. Like the few of us, there were only a few of us anyway. And then those who went on to get their doctorates were saying that, that was like a piece of cake comparatively. So I mean, it just shows, like how hard that program actually was. And I had to work harder than other people too, because I did have those undiagnosed learning disabilities. I didn't know about it. I didn't understand why it took me longer. I didn't understand why everybody that, not like, again, there's not a lot of people, but the few people in my cohort, like they were able to type. I couldn't type. I was the only one, and my professor was like, I don't understand. How can you be this old and not type? But now I know it's the connection and my processing and my fine motor skill. Like, I know now, but then it was
more as less a side note
again.
Yeah. Which, as a side note, when you are in burnout and when you tip over into the chronic illness sphere of things, you lose even more of that connectivity and that fine motor skills. You lose even more of your executive functioning, your ability to remember things. You know, you get brain fog. You have all of these different things become infinitely harder when you are in that space. And so and then, you know, I don't know if you experienced this, but I know that for me and a lot of women I've talked to, there's also that aspect of, I'm pretty sure that this is harder for me than other people. But then when you try to check that with other people, they're like, no, it's hard for everyone.
It
no,
is.
Everyone's having a hard
if
time.
You're even, if you even feel like you can, because then you're right. Like, because you, when you're little, they say try harder. Right? Like, you're not trying hard enough. You should be able to do this. Yep. You're smart. They dismiss you. So you don't even try anymore. Right? And that continued. I got all caught up despite, you know, all the things. Went on to, I moved, literally moved, in order to do my internship because I wanted to work specifically with people who were autistic and had intellectual differences. So I had to move to be able to do that.
And were you diagnosed at this time?
No.
So you didn't know you were neurodivergent, but you knew you wanted to work with neurodivergent people.
I always suspected. I wanted to. Oh yeah. Like I,
okay.
Yeah. I definitely suspected, but no, I was not formally diagnosed. I'd never been evaluated.
Well, yeah.
You know,
you're a woman who was in like a, you know, college and apparently doing fine because you got that plaque.
Well,
like,
I mean, I
who
was
would ever think that you're
else.
Neurodivergent?
I was better than everybody else. I had to be. So, of course, I didn't sleep. I didn't, you know, nobody saw the other parts, right?
Yeah.
And you get, you like you mentioned earlier, you get that praise.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the only, because you never got it before. Mm-hmm. So you do everything you can to be able to get something besides criticism. Or being ignored, right? So that,
so you moved to focus on working with neurodivergent kids, is that right?
For my internship, these were all adults.
Okay.
And then I would see kids at the clinic, you know, as well when I would go back to where the university was. But it was a developmental center. And so there were cottages everywhere. Now, again, I'm talking about a long time ago. A lot of these places have been closed and a lot of people are in group homes in the community. So this is kind of during that time where they started making that shift, thank goodness. But I wanted to go to this place in particular because I really was interested in working with the folks there. So there were, I believe, 18 cottages. So I would have to run between cottages. I have to know where all the bathrooms are. I have to have all my clothes with me. And then on top of that, I would put clothes strategically in different cottages.
Like a squirrel.
Exactly. And I didn't have any money, so I don't even have that many clothes.
Yeah.
Like, I had to be really careful. And then, you
so
know,
much laundry too, which so I'm just going to say for me, like for the longest time, laundry was like a huge executive function mountain drain. And so like, I can't even imagine. Actually, I can't imagine because I did cloth diapers with my son when he was a baby. So I absolutely can't imagine that level of laundry.
It
was exhausting.
It's a lot. And I couldn't eat or drink anything all day until I got home at 6:30 at night.
So completely depleted, not putting in the stuff that your body needs.
Because I can't.
Like, just completely stressed. Like, yeah.
Yeah, because I was still
like,
having
you're doing
accidents.
What, like, and that's the only stuff that you knew how to do to try and manage what was going on for you.
Right.
And
so
also,
another person would just be like, I'm too sick to do this right now. Not me, because I had to keep proving myself. So people were confused when I was always wearing different clothes every day. Like, they'd see me in the morning and then, you know, an hour later I'd have something else on.
Did you ever like Did you ever mess with people? I feel like I would mess with people and just be like, "Oh, I'm learning to be a quick change artist. I'm preparing for my second career in Vegas."
I wasn't that fast. And I was,
But they
yeah,
don't need to know that.
that's true. That's true. Yeah, I'd just be like, ha, yeah. I got something on my clothes. I spilled some food or whatever, right? So, being even able to live was a full-time job on top of how do I figure out what this looks like in my life? And then I accepted a position after I graduated. And, it just got to the point where I just had to get a permanent, ileostomy because it was not going to work. And just, kind of mourning my own body because there is no reconstruction. There's no reconstruction for that. This is my intestine will forever be coming out of my stomach. Like I have an organ coming out of me. And I'm so thankful that I'm still alive because I would have been dead. And I considered it. I actually considered just dying several times because that was, I felt would be ultimately easier. But I also knew that I wanted to have this life and I had to figure out how to make that happen. So,
And I just want to recognize that holding that gratitude and that grief, that oftentimes it's hard for neurodivergent women to even do that. Like they're like, no, I have to, like, I can only be grateful, right? Like that's the only thing that feels safe. But you get to be grateful that you're alive and also that you are grieving so much loss with your health, with what could have been if you'd gotten the supports that you needed or the diagnosis or, or the like l much less stress, like what could have been. Both of those get to coexist. And I love that you have gotten to a place where you're able to hold both of those in your experience.
And I am too, because I definitely wasn't then. Well, you're glad, you're supposed to be dead. You should be glad that
Be
you're
grateful.
alive. Be grateful that your body is forever looking like this, and you're still single. And
And I do want to, like, gratitude is very powerful and it's a very important piece of, mental and physical wellness. It is. But
it is.
the spiritual bypassing of telling someone that they should be grateful and using it almost as a weapon to get them to stop with whatever that person feels is uncomfortable, or that that person, isn't able to handle the other person's emotions, right? Like that is not okay. Let's stop that.
Well, it's also that piece of, well, you're getting blamed for being sick. I remember my uncle, I guess he's my ex-uncle. I don't know what you call that after a divorce, but you just need to drink a V8, Holly. That makes sense.
Yeah, I'm sure that'll solve all my
This is
problems.
an organic disease. Like you can see it. You can see literally parts of my intestines are dead inside my body. But a V8's not going to fix that. Or I need to pray harder. Okay. I had heard, well, it must be something you're eating. So we have this, not only are we carrying everything and trying with a smile on our faces, but then we're told it's our fault.
And also given a ton of confusing and overwhelming, like, do this, this will fix it, try this, do that, and then at some point it's like, at what point are you like, well, I'm just going to, nothing's going to make it better, I'm just going to whatever, right? I'm just going to squirrel my clothes away and hope to make it through the day.
Or the next 5 seconds, right? So yeah, I accepted a position in a different state and I went there in the hospital a lot and dealing with all of that, like, 'cause you have to get your work done, right? Even when you're in the hospital. But it certainly wasn't as much pressure. I mean, the disease wasn't any more forgiving, but at least I wasn't in school. Because the idea was, again, I am supposed to get my PhD. I've been supposed to have that journey. since I can remember. I'm supposed to be Dr. Holly.
All the shoulds.
All of them. And I was told by several, I'm not talking about one, but by several doctors, if you do that, you're going to die.
I'm glad they said it,
Yeah,
because
I'm actually
a lot of people
surprised.
don't have someone who will tell them, who will be that direct and be like, no, this is not a good idea.
And these are
And
the
so
people
I'm
that
really glad
have
they did that.
seen the inside of my body,
Yeah.
right? Like these are the people that have seen the organs. And they're saying, not family members weren't saying this. I didn't hear that from any friends or family members. These were doctors saying, like, no, I'm telling you that you will probably not make it to graduation. And if you do, you're going to die soon after.
Yeah.
And so that was just like just devastating on top of
Yeah,
everything else.
more grieving, which I don't know
Yeah.
if you're able to access even at that point, but
No,
like,
I
yeah, that's,
wasn't. I
yeah.
was just sad and depressed and anxious and maybe they're wrong. Maybe these Mayo Clinic doctors are wrong. Right? The best in the world. Maybe they just don't know.
Yeah.
But they don't know me. They don't know how strong
How
I am or
determined and
how
how strong.
pushed.
Yep.
Right?
Exactly. But that's the
So,
thing
yeah.
is they absolutely were taking that into consideration. It's the pushing and it's the determination and it's the doing it while your body's falling apart that
Right.
would end up killing you.
Right.
And I feel like that's a message. In the neurodivergent community, there's this concept of assuming ability, right? And I get that. And I appreciate that. And also, there's this simultaneous thing, especially with high masking neurodivergent women, of not being able to accurately judge within their own body what it can handle because of all of these things that we've been talking about, and their determination to reach the goal, to meet the expectation, to do the thing that they genuinely want to do or that they feel like they need to do, causes them to, just like your doctors were saying, push themselves until they're gonna die, right? Like, to the point of complete and total collapse. And so finding out how to navigate that, and I don't have the answer necessarily, but finding out how to navigate that balance between, yes, you are capable, yes, you can do all kinds of things, and also, we want to make sure that the things that you're doing are the things that are right for you, and that you're doing them in a way that you have the support and at the pace that is right for you and your body.
Yeah, and I'm glad to say that we're having this conversation right now is just evidence of things are better.
Yeah.
We have a lot of ways to go because you think about the damage that we're doing to neurodivergent kids and teens, that they would be at a point where they would rather die than not accomplish this goal because they just
Yeah.
want so desperately to matter. They want
Yeah.
so much desperately because they're so criticized or they're surrounded with you're wrong, you're bad, you're
Yeah.
this. And so then we dive 110% in of trying to be, see, I'm not that. See, I'm not lazy.
And also, when that happens, I feel like it's often framed as being their fault. It's their fault they want to die. It's their fault that they are so fixated on this goal instead of being framed as what it is, which is a societal failing. It's that these kids are not getting the support that they need. They're not getting an understanding of themselves and the ability to trust their body and make decisions about that, and that compounds over time and leads to that. So, yeah,
Yeah.
it's absolutely, yes, that is happening within our neurodivergent community, within especially, kids, teens, young adults, that is absolutely happening. And also, it's not their fucking fault.
Right. Exactly. Well said. And it's yeah, why anyone thinks someone's suffering needs more blame, I don't know. But
Right?
guess what, everybody? It makes it worse.
Yeah, it's
Yeah.
not a moral failing because they're neurodivergent. It's
Right.
because all of these other things have conspired to put them in this position.
Exactly. And then, even when, I was in the hospital, because I've been in the hospital a whole lot, I literally cannot remember how many times because it was so many that why, I'm not asking for this. Like, who asks for this? No, I didn't sign up for it. I didn't want it. Blaming me is not going to help.
Or like
So,
the suspicion of like, oh, you want attention, or you're after drugs, or something like that. Like I've encountered that with medical
ridiculous.
professionals, and I'm like, I don't even take ibuprofen except like once a year. I that's not what's happening here. But like that suspicion and stuff is definitely there, and that blaming and all of that. So Holly, obviously you've been on this long journey with your health, with chronic illness. Can you tell me now, as it stands, what is your relationship with your body, with your wellness? How is that showing up for you in your day-to-day life at this point?
And it's such a good question because I have a long journey. Because again, I am 51. I'm very proud to say. It is hard. I just stopped a biologic and because it wasn't working. So now I've had two loading doses on to the next one. And then I was looking at my schedule for clients and I thought, this is interesting when I look at my schedule now. Instead of blaming myself, like, that's so terrible, Holly. You have an 8-hour infusion that Wednesday, which means I can't see anybody. The next day, I have in a morning an appointment, which won't take that long. So that's not going to mess it up too bad. And then the next day after that, so this is just like a chunk of 3 days, I have an infusion in the afternoon, but that's only going to take 2.5 hours. So what does that mean? Right. So just trying to like piece everything together with a lot less self-blame is a beautiful thing. And it's been through all these trials that I've been able to get to this point. I do mental health therapy for myself every week. I do body shame. Sometimes it'll sneak up on me, but I'm doing better with it.
It's a process.
It is a
It's a long
process.
process.
And now that I've had 3 different episodes of pulmonary emboli, which is unheard of, even dealing with the advocacy part of that, and I'm so proud of myself because I had an allergic reaction to the top three blood thinners now, the ones that you don't have to monitor your own blood. They put me in the hospital. So now, warfarin, I never say that right, but like I have to check my blood a lot to see is it too thin, too thick, whatever. And I advocated fully for the very first time with this nurse telling her, I will not remember the day you tell me. I will not remember that I'm supposed to check my blood because I have this little machine at home that I have to do it on and I have to put it in an app and then email them. She's been amazing. I'd never knew I never felt like I could do that before. If I could say, please email me that day and say,
I need
Holly,
this simple accommodation.
check your blood. Holly, check your blood today. And then after that, answer these questions. And all of them are pre-written out. So I don't have to do anything but say yes or no. And
That's
that
beautiful.
doesn't make me less.
No.
And although I'm like, gosh, I wish I would have had these skills before, but the bottom line is many of us go through our entire lives not having them. So I'm so proud of myself and excited for the opportunity to say, I need this. I'm already stretched for my executive functioning. I can't take one more thing on. Can you please do this for me? And that doesn't make me less. That makes me more self-aware and a better advocate.
Absolutely. And I love that, I think all of us who have kind of been through the chronic illness and the medical system and that kind of stuff, we have a lot of negative experiences and a lot of experiences of being gaslit or invalidated or
Or
being
screamed at.
misinterpreted.
I've been screamed at as while I'm inpatient. Because doctors have
I haven't had that
egos.
one. But yes. And so I just want to say that while I know that still happens and that there are people still experiencing that, I do feel hopeful hearing experiences like yours where not only is it your own personal growth to be able to advocate for yourself and be able to ask for what you need and to be able to feel less shame around your needs and taking care of your body. And also, I think it shows some growth within the medical industry that some of the changes and the steps that they've been making over the last few years are increasing accessibility. They are making it, I'm not going to say easy, but easier
It is
for
easier.
neurodivergent women to get the care that they actually need within those systems and get the support that they're actually needing.
I love that. It's true. And even like you were saying, there's always room for growth. The last time that I had an episode of pulmonary emboli, I thought I was having a heart attack. They each time presented differently.
Oh,
So this
wow.
last time, it felt like a vise. I was sitting at the desk where I'm talking to you right now. It felt like a vise was on my chest, and it didn't feel that way the last two times. They were all different presentations. And I've never had a clot in my leg, so there's no way to even know it's coming, right? Like a lot of people might have a blood clot in their leg, and they never had any blood clots in my legs. There's no way I knew it was coming from one second to the next, which is also really scary. So I went to the emergency department. It was packed. I said, I think I'm having a heart attack, because I really did think so. And they did an EKG, whatever, in the waiting area and said, no, you're not. You're probably fine. And then I was lower on the list. So I assumed I was in all this pain. I assumed once I got back there that they understood that I had, this history of PEs, which is obviously pretty dangerous. And as they were discharging me, I mentioned, well, so you don't think it's a PE either? And then the ER doctor was like, I didn't even think to check for that. And then, of course, they did, an MRI, and it was so bad they couldn't count them. It looked like somebody had spray painted blood clots across both my lungs. So you can see how scary that is, especially for people like us that don't make a big deal out of anything. We minimize everything. I could have walked out there and just died because I didn't think to mention, or I felt like I couldn't mention. Because here's somebody in an authority figure that's telling me nothing's wrong with you.
And that fawn response kicks in. And it's like, well, they must know. We're trained to trust other people over trusting ourselves. And so, yeah, that is. It's scary and it's dangerous. And you being able to advocate and then them being able to hear you when you said when you're like, it, did you check for PE? Could it possibly be a PE? Like for them to be able to be like, oh, this is a legitimate thing. I should probably follow up and ask more questions and figure out if this is a thing, rather than just being, oh no, that's nope, you're fine. Like I think that shows progress on both sides, which is
I
very
do too.
important. Thank you so much, Holly, for coming and talking with me. And I know we could talk for hours and hours and hours,
Okay.
but we'll wrap there. If you want to connect with Holly or learn more about her and her services, I've included some links in the show notes. If you're a healer, creative, or mom who is ready to make safety, authenticity, and alignment your default settings in life instead of something that you just glimpse now and then, there are currently openings in my dedicated one-on-one container, Sacred Creatrix. The link for that is also in the show notes. Take a look, and if it feels aligned for you, if you feel called to it in any way, go ahead and book your free discovery call, and we can navigate together whether this is the right time and the right way to support you in your nervous system recovery and expansion journey.